Hey everyone, and welcome to this special Soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast. I'm Patrick Gray. There's no weekly show this week. As many of you would know, we had a baby here in the Risky Business household last week. So this week is more about family duty than doing anything else. But I'd already recorded this Soapbox special, so I thought it would make sense to push it out this week. These Soapbox podcasts are wholly sponsored, and I like to think of them as a sort of keynote interview. And this edition of Soapbox is brought to you by Bug Crowd. So over the next 40 minutes or so, you'll hear a conversation between the Bug Crowd CTO and founder, Casey Ellis, and me. As most of you would know, Bug Crowd runs outsourced bug bounty programs for a wide variety of organizations, from Silicon Valley mega brands to financial services and banking to development-heavy SMEs. You know, Bug Crowd is found in all of these places. And what a time it is for the bug bounty business. There's a lot of attention on the bug bounty concept at the moment. We even saw a Senate subcommittee hearing in the United States all about bug bounties. That took place earlier this month. And it's a really competitive sector as well, so there's a lot going on. So in this conversation, Casey's going to tell us about what Bug Crowd is doing to try to add some innovation to bug bounty programs. As you'll hear, he's got some really great ideas. And I came into this as a bit of a skeptic, as in, you know, how can you innovate around something as simple as a bug bounty program? But it turns out you can. And we also try to make the case that bug bounties are these days an established part of InfoSec, you know, just like a boring regular part of the InfoSec mix. So we cover off some interesting stuff Bug Crowd is doing, and then we talk about how the bug bounty provider types might be able to actually engage their crowds in defensive work, which is a hell of a plot twist. And, you know, we talk a lot about the recent Uber kerfuffle as well and what that means for bug bounties. That was the incident where Uber was extorted by someone who'd owned them and downloaded a bunch of PII. Uber wound up paying the attacker in Bitcoin via their HackerOne bug bounty program. And boy, did that open a can of worms, which actually wound up resulting in said Senate subcommittee hearing. Anyway, I'll drop you in here to this conversation where Casey is explaining one thing Bug Crowd is doing, which is like access provisioning for bug bounty testers. They've developed a check-in, check-out system that actually works. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Cheers.
So essentially what happens and how it works, like if you think about a traditional consulting engagement, usually what happens is the consultant will come in and have a couple of accounts created for them within the environment that they're testing. And that's to provide, cross account checks and authenticated access, all of those sorts of things that you can't get without that information. So the problem that we wanted to try to overcome, and we have overcome with this particular feature, is, how do you extend that concept out to, 20, 50, 100 people in the context, particularly of private programs where we're, going in off the back of an organization that wants to improve their pen test ROI.
So, what are these credentials that you're provisioning actually get them access to? Are these like staging servers with new apps on them? Because that'd make a lot of sense.
Yeah, it can be anything. Like typically it's staging or UAT. We've had customers do it in production as well. I mean, what it comes down to is, at the point that they're bulk loading these types of credentials for testing into their systems, they want to make sure that they've got, very good visibility over when they're being used, who's using them, how they're being used and so on. And, really what we end up doing is we not only facilitate access to those credentials on the hacker side of things, but the data around how they're being checked in and checked out passes back to the client and helps them, decipher the whole thing after the fact as well.
I mean, the first question that comes to mind is, can you actually auto-provision them in open bounties just so that you can tie individual actions to individual testers? Does that work? Is that something you can do?
It does. It works. It doesn't scale terribly well because I think with an open bounty program, if you've provisioned manually 100 accounts and you've got 1,000 people rocking up wanting to participate, you end up with a challenge. And I think most of the time with the open programs, there's generally some sort of self-provisioning function there anyway. So this is mostly around private systems or private environments, things that are behind a firewall, like pre-production systems where we're testing where, self-provisioning hasn't been set up yet and stuff like that.
Okay,
so yeah,
that
I mean,
sense,
it can definitely be done, but there is a scale challenge that we have to work around there. So it's better suited to private programs, I think.
Now, Casey, there is a bit more to it, isn't there, than just throwing bounties open and picking 50, trusted people. You talk about this concept of composing a custom crowd for a private bounty. Can you go into that a bit?
So, you know, a lot of what we do with the crowd and the community is to understand who's who, like who's good at what, who has what kind of, skill sets from a technology standpoint, but also, you know, propensities in terms of certain bug classes, like understandings of particular types of systems and so on. And I think, you know, with that information, what it lets us do is segment out how we put crowds together for programs when, you know, people are coming in and doing stuff where it's by invitation. Like we have a system that we've built, we call it ACS, and what it's doing is basically going through the information that we have on each person that's signed up on the platform and finding the best fit. And the way that we do that is we look at, you know, skills, impacts, how active they are, and then how much we trust them. And those four things together, basically what you do is you marry the requirements of the customer and the target with the the data that we have on each person and build out the right crowd to get the job done.
Yeah, so this is about inviting the right people for the IoT bounty versus the web app bounty, you know, the PHP one versus the whatever, you know, the Java one or whatever.
Yeah, put simply, yeah. But it's a little bit deeper than that because I think, you know, part of what we also do is we make sure that there's a diversity in how they test. So, like, when you think about it, there's hackers that are very good at, like, call it QA-style testing. So they'll run around and look for, you know, call it the simpler issues, but they'll look for those things in places where other people just don't go. But then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got, you know, the evil genius types. Yeah. That are just, you know, the whole thing is
someone who accidentally just created an entire new bug class.
Exactly. Like people that the technology and the symptoms and all that stuff is almost transparent to them. They're just going after the gold.
Yeah.
Like the thing is,
they've come up with a new deserialization vector or something really exotic.
Yeah, exactly. So the thing about that is that I think the misconception is that you're only after the people that can do the really, really cool stuff. And you definitely are, but you also want other folk that are going to focus on being thorough to make sure that you get, you know, full coverage of the target space. So that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about where, you know, when we're teaming people up and actually composing a crowd to do a job, that's, you know, one of the things that we think about.
Now, the next one I want to ask you about, and it's not entirely new, and in fact, you know, it's been a thing in pen testing for a long time, is actually funneling tester traffic through a fairly sophisticated, but a well set up VPN, essentially. And what I find interesting about this is that it actually gives you, it gives you access control, right, for various testers, but it also gives you visibility into whether or not your apps are still being tested. And I think that's the really interesting point for me. Can you just tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. This is something that we've actually been doing since day dot. Like if you go and fish out the original Startbait pitch I did in 2012, I'm talking about it back on that one as well. So it's really what we've released over the past 6 months is the latest iteration of it. But you know, you hit the nail on the head. There's a couple of different purposes for it. Access control is definitely one. So giving customers the ability to open or shut access to the systems that are under test based on what they need to do. Obviously access control and provisioning of the individuals that are participating. And then this whole idea of coverage, like the interesting thing there is that, you know, when you first launch a crowdsourced security program, what happens is, you know, there's a phase that I call clearing assurance debt, which we colloquially, we affectionately refer to here as the oh shit moment.
The bug tsunami, if you will.
The bug tsunami, essentially. and what that is it's a bunch of firepower being applied, a bunch of creativity and intelligence being applied in a way that it hasn't been in that environment before. So there's
it's the modern day equivalent of running Nessus for the first time, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. You find out a bunch of stuff you didn't know before. But then what happens after that is things start to get resolved and you know, over time, ideally as the customer gets better or the program owner gets better at not reintroducing or creating new things, the question comes up, okay, well, are we still getting tested? Like, is the assurance in the first phase, it's about discovery. That's the key point of value. In the second phase, it's actually more about assurance. It's not so much what you find because you still do find stuff.
It's to know that people are still looking.
Yeah. It's like, are these things still going on? And we've seen some great examples of customers that, you know, they've been running programs for 2 or 3 years and, increased their bounty reward pools over that period of time as a way to keep testers engaged. and actually regressed bugs back into their production environment that have been picked up very quickly by the crowd. So that's good. That's an example of the fact that it is happening. But what we wanted to do with traffic control is provide an added like layer of confidence and an added layer of data to the customer to help them actually understand that that is going on.
It's cool, right? Because this is a way that you can differentiate probes from some rando from someone who's actually coming in via your platform.
That's definitely the other part. Like the whole idea of, you know, a single source of access, that actually does mitigate one of the concerns that many folk have. Like if I'm running a crowdsourced program, but I have an incident response team that, you know, is tripped over by a scan or a probe or whatever else, like how am I going to tell good faith traffic from bad? So this overcomes that hurdle as well.
I wonder too if there's encouragement you could give people to actually use the VPN, because on public properties, there's not really going to be much point for them. But can you arrange VPN access to, say, drop in behind a WAF so that testers might get like a little bit more access and not get booted by some, you know, or auto-blocked by some WAF? Is that the carrot that you use to get people to use it?
That's one of them. I think another is if it's an environment that's just not publicly addressable. Like that's the easiest way to do this. If you're dropping in behind a firewall or looking at an environment that's not, you know, available to the public internet, this becomes, you know, the only way to get to it, which makes it very simple. If it's a public system, I mean, there's different things that we've done. And you're right, like if you can publicly route around it, then you can't fully guarantee that people are using it 100% of the time. But there are things that we can do to incentivize and maximize that, the chance that they will, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
and at the end of the day, what it comes down to is if there's enough traffic going through, like in that circumstance where it's a publicly addressable target and we're using traffic control, if there's enough traffic that's still going through the VPN to actually, you know, tell that story around coverage, then at the end of the day, everyone goes home happy. But yeah, again, this is one of those ones where there's certain scenarios, which are very common, by the way, where this is perfect for it. And there's others where we can, you know, make it work, but it's not designed for that.
I would also imagine that between the check-in, check-out stuff, which is mostly for private bounties, and the traffic control stuff, you're going to be collecting some... I mean, it's not going to be trivial to do this, but I can imagine there's potential for you to collect some pretty impressive telemetry on individual testers. Is that part of the overall strategy here?
Yeah, I mean, a big thing that we're always looking and learning around is, you know, who's good at what? Like, what are the different skill sets that exist? What's the capability of... for impact, you know, what kind of activity level can we expect out of each individual? And then to an extent, how much do we trust them as well? And this is just another data source for our ability to do that. What that lets us do, you know, as it goes forward and that data set gets bigger, is to get better at connecting the right hackers to the right target and the right incentive, which is kind of the core of the value proposition when we're going in and talking to people about pen test and next gen stuff like that.
Yeah. Now, in our early interviews, I remember you and I talking about the idea of using crowdsourced security testing or bug bounties, whatever you want to call it. The idea of using this approach to do PCI DSS, like to tick the box for testing. And you were saying, this is years ago, you were saying there is no reason that people couldn't do this. The hang up was always going to be the way that was presented. You know, the paperwork, right? You know, you've got to be able to hand this stuff off to a PCI auditor, a QSA, who's going to go tick, yep, that's all qualified, that's fine. You've actually cracked that nut now.
Yeah. And that, I think that original conversation was in the days of PCI DSS 1.2, and we've moved on from that. So there's two parts to it. One is to make sure that the sub-requirements of any given requirement are satisfied by the process. But then to your point, there's you know, the aspect of making sure that the output is something that an auditor is going to understand and deem compliant. You know, the challenge to doing that, or the challenge that we had before we fixed it, was the idea that, yeah, this is like radically more effective than just paying someone by the hour. But, you know, you put it in front of an auditor that's looking at 100 other things and they say, what the hell's crowdsourcing? So we wanted to overcome that problem as well. And really what we did there is we had a couple of clients actually approach us on this one and prod us along, which was kind of cool.
One of them is a mega corporation with a very well-known CISO, but I'm guessing you can't name them.
Yes, that's correct.
That is a shame. But anyway, continue.
But that is accurate also. And then working with auditors, you know, for these various companies as well, to basically go out and, you know, give us the tick of approval in terms of our approach. And then when the customer actually used it, you know, kind of completing the circle at that point as well. So that's been really cool. That's actually been a really fun journey to get that whole thing built and approved, because obviously, you know, I've spent a bunch of time in payment card security back in the day. So there's a little bit of, you know, personal interest there as well.
Well, I think it's real, like, you know, for better or worse, it's real meat and potatoes security work these days. And if you can boil that down,
yeah,
exactly, right. And if you can boil that down into a really simple, easy to deliver product, I mean, you know, not only are you solving a lot of problems for people out there who have to do this stuff, but you're going to make what I'd probably best describe as a, you know, buttload of cash.
Yeah, and do a better job in the process, which is good too.
Yeah, that's right. So we've been recording for like 10 minutes now, right? And and we have so far, I think, already made a pretty compelling case that this industry, this discipline has matured. I think something else that makes that case, and this is a bit of a weird way to get there, but bear with me. This Uber thing, I think, has actually turned into a net positive for the discipline, because you've got government hearings. And I obviously watched the recent Senate subcommittee hearing into the Uber kerfuffle. And what I found interesting about it is most of the committee members had obviously gone to their staff and asked for briefings. And they were well briefed. They seemed to – it seems like now people in government making real decisions because of this Uber screw-up now know an awful lot about crowdsourced security and were asking the right sort of questions. Does that make you hopeful?
It does, and you know, honestly, I watched the hearing a couple of times myself. I commend, you know, Uber's position going in there, you know, frankly eating a bit of crow over the whole thing.
Oh man, and that was the mea culpa masterclass, basically.
Yeah, but I think, you know, in terms of probably one of the goals they had in doing that was to protect this industry and this relationship as it goes forward. So that was a really cool move on their part. And I agree. Like the way that Senator Moran came out and the others that were talking about this stuff, they did seem quite well versed on the mechanics of what's going on. You know, the thing that I was most nervous about going into that hearing was that confusion that led into it about the difference between bug bounty and extortion.
Yeah, that it would persist. I know exactly
that it would persist through that. And I was, you know, I got to say, I breathed a pretty heavy sigh of relief a couple of minutes into the introduction. So yeah, I agree.
Now, you and I have already discussed the Uber thing, right? So I don't want to get bogged down too much into it. But the key issue, and again, I was so impressed that the Senate subcommittee zeroed in on this. The whole issue, you know, the key issue and the key conundrum here really seems to revolve around the issue of what do we do about PII in testing. So they quickly understood that, okay, this thing wasn't really happening within the confines of a bug bounty. That's fine. But what do you do in an actual bug bounty when PII is involved? Like, how do you cover that from a, you know, and I'm not talking a risk perspective as in a compliance sense, but I mean in terms of actual risk that something's going wrong. And again, you know, and how do you comply it? And again, how do you cover it off in the legal and compliance sense? Do you think that that's clear yet, or do you think we're still figuring it out? Because I feel like we're still figuring it out.
I feel very much like we're still figuring it out. And, you know, I think this is something that you've said a couple of times. Like, a lot of this industry has been operating surprisingly successfully on good faith for the past 5 years. So I think, you know, really what it's boiled down to is that
nothing,
you know,
really bad has happened until this Uber thing.
Well, but also with the Uber thing, like, there's a pretty clear difference between a POC and 57 million records. So,
yeah,
you know, that passes the common sense test, I think, for pretty much anyone who's looking on. What it comes down to in my mind, and where this will, you know, if the whole idea of inadvertent actions of white hats gets rolled into mandatory federal breach disclosure stuff, the way that Senator Moran was pushing in the hearing, it'll come down to, you know, really qualifying the difference between good faith hacking and bad faith. And you know, the challenge with that is that intent at scale is pretty difficult to determine
from
the receiving end, right?
That's right. And as I've often remarked on the show before, you know, people in the United States seem very, very process oriented. They like to have strict rules that they can use to determine what is right and what is wrong. There doesn't seem to be much wiggle room in the culture, if that makes sense. But I'm reminded of something that happened here in Australia that was very big news at the time, but it's been long enough that I think probably we have a whole bunch of new listeners who might not know this story, but a guy here named Patrick Webster, or OSHAC, was logged into his pension fund. In Australia, we have like private pension funds that you sort of contribute to in a mandatory sense, in a mandatory way. He was logged in once, and then he just changed like a number in the URL because he's like, this looks a little bit like a direct object. And sure enough, someone else's pension statement came up. So what he did is he set up a script to download, to just increment and download these PDFs while he made a cup of tea. I think he downloaded a couple of hundred of them, prepared a little report, zipped it up, sent it to them as a proof of concept. And then he had the cops on his door very quickly, and it turned into a huge drama. In the end, it worked out okay for him, and the company backed down. But there was a situation where PIA was downloaded, but this guy, I mean, he used to be an on-staff penetration tester for New South Wales Police. Like, he was clearly, his intent was clearly good, but there is a case where some PIA has been downloaded, and the intentions were actually good. Whereas in this Uber case, it was the blackmail that sort of gave away the intentions, right? Yeah. So I'm wondering, like, and this is where it gets really hard, right? If it just comes down to intent, that would be simple, but it doesn't, does it? Because if you download 10 million records, all of a sudden, you know, the organization has to worry about the security of those records, right? If it's just 200 or whatever, you don't. So how do we find this line, Casey? I mean, you see the dilemma, right?
No, 100%. And this is why I keep coming back to the idea that, you know, there will need to be some sort of line or some sort of sniff test around how to create a line in individual circumstances as this scales out. Because I think, you know, now, I mean, with the stuff with Pat Webster and you know, that whole incident, you could argue both angles for both parties when you think about it, right?
100%,
and it's like, okay, so it's one of these ones where it's like, well, okay, that was well-intentioned, but, you know, on the receiving side of that, I can sort of understand why they freaked out and went after him as well. Not that I thought that that was the right thing to do, but you can kind of, you know, you can't really pull it apart and make it black and white. So
I mean, I kind of hammered them, you know, on, you know, with a few blog posts and whatever, and it turned into a big, big stink in the media. But, you know, I could take Pat Webster's side because I knew him. They didn't know him.
Yeah,
so they had no way of knowing his intent, right?
Exactly. So the key challenge, I think, with this, and you hit the nail on the head there, like, you know Pat, right? And I think the difference between you know, PII, potential PII disclosure in the context of a penetration test or in context of a private bug bounty or whatever else, is that it's covered under two things. One is the fact that the people that you're inviting are known to the parties that are involved and there's agreement ahead of time, but also that there's usually NDAs and you know, contractual language around like what the rules of disclosure and destruction are that are set up ahead of time.
So do you think it could wind up being as simple as PII in a private bounty where the participants have signed NDAs and it's almost like a contracted scenario that the PII handling is a little bit looser there, but in the open bounties, you just have a hard rule saying none?
I think that's, I mean, that to me seems like the logical kind of conclusion of all of this. Because when you think about how it works, that's how it works now. You know, when you're going in as a consultant to do testing on an environment, you don't know what you're going to stumble onto because that's the whole point. That's why you're there in the first place, right? Mm. So to be able to have coverage over that to the extent that it doesn't actually interfere with your ability to do good work, there is good faith that's extended under those contracts. And I think, you know, as long as you can put the same sorts of controls and vouching things in place around who you're bringing into the programs, you know, there's no reason that shouldn't continue to apply, like regardless of whether there's one person doing the work or 100. Where it gets tricky is where you don't have that kind of pre-interaction and it's someone just coming in off the internet, you know, interacting with you for the first time. That's where, like, that starts to break down. And I think, you know, that's probably what will end up happening. It'll be, okay, if there's some sort of, there'll be some sort of red flag or some sort of trigger that, you know, differentiates between a good proof of concept and something that actually constitutes a disclosable data breach.
Yeah, and see, the people who've got to worry about that, that's the government. You know, they've got to be the ones who make that determination, and that's going to be hard, given that they're not the people really in the industry, eh? It's
like, yeah. And look, I mean, my intention on that, and you know, I've heard Katie talking about this as well, and others in the space, is to be pretty proactive about making sure that we're trying to help them do that. So hopefully, I mean, I'm generally optimistic. I think when it comes to this whole model, you know, I always saw a day coming at some point where people would start to adjust regulation because of the you know, the paradigms that it challenges, right? And, you know, the whole Uber thing kind of precipitated that, I think, a little earlier than I thought it would. But that's happening and was already going to. So, yeah, I think the net of it is that, you know, this can actually turn out to be a really good thing as long as it's approached rationally and with good expert input. And that, you know, I think one of the jerked in fear.
Of course. But I think one of the issues is that I think people in InfoSec and technology generally are a little bit blasé about stuff that freaks the government out. Do you know what I mean? So even for them to go, what, even if it's a private bounty, what, you've got 200 people that you mostly know, you've kind of got their identity verified or whatever, but you're not, you know, like you don't know them. And what, they're allowed to run off with PII? Like, how is this a thing? Do you know? And I've been sort of worried about that reaction, like whether or not the government can adjust to this idea that there are testers signed to platforms that are kind of allowed to access PII from major corporations in the United States. But they seem to get their head around it pretty quick.
They did. And I think, you know, that's to the credit of some of the folks in DDS that really pushed that forward, I think, in spite of a lot of those questions from others within the Pentagon. So, you know, I think that initial kind of proof point and the initial success of that program, and then, you know, that being coupled with all the success that's happening out in the corporate space, that's really, you know, gotten them all sitting up and paying attention to it.
Well, and if we can find some clear guidance here, then it almost neuters the need. I mean, the CFAA, you know, everyone knows I'm not a huge fan of it, but I mean, if we can actually get some norms established here and some good common sense guidelines, it's almost like the CFAA reform component just becomes a little less critical, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Like this, I mean, ultimately I see a lot of these things, you know, what this comes down to, like CFAA, this stuff, like the Wassenaar Agreement, like there's all of these different conversations that revolve around this core topic of hacking being a dual use activity. And one that has, you know, scared the shit out of people for the past 30 years. And now we're starting to realize it's valuable. So we need to figure out how to deal with the good side of it while still protecting ourselves from the bad side.
Yeah,
it's an interesting journey, that's for sure.
Now, I asked you to listen to my interview with Katie Masouris, you know, who is a good friend of mine and a good friend of yours. Certainly I know that, right? So, you had to listen to her. Yeah, you had to listen to her conversation with me based on her, you know, Senate subcommittee testing, and she had some really interesting things to say. Like, you know, the success of bug bounties is all very well and good, but to a degree, it's like, hey, can't we actually maybe address the root cause of bugs in the first place and incentivize defensive thinking over offensive thinking? You know, it's an interesting idea. I don't know whether or not defensive incentivization is ever going to be as effective. But what are some ideas that you might have had? Because Casey, you know, you and I, listeners may or may not know this, but you and I are actually quite close friends. And we've had some epic conversations about this sort of stuff. And you're interested in security, but I think the thing that really gets you, gets you excited about the business that you run is less about the actual InfoSec angle and more about the power of the crowd. So I'm guessing that you would have had time to think about possible defensive uses for the crowd. Have you come up with anything? Like, is there ever going to be such a thing as a remediation bounty? Because that could be interesting. I know a few people who'd like one of them.
Yeah, no, most definitely. Look, yeah, I've got a whiteboard and about 50 notebooks filled with ideas around this one. And there's different approaches that we've experimented with and taken to it. So yeah, that is something that we look at and something that we work on. I do think the idea of, you know, having the crowd basically brought to bear to actually help create things that can be used for defense is not outside the realms of possibility. Like it's tricky because, you know, people outside of an organization lack the context of the people within the organization. So there's a hurdle to overcome there, but I don't think it's impossible. But I think, you know, south of that, you know, in my mind, the reason that we suck at security is because we don't know that we suck at security. That's like the primary cause, like people that are responsible for, you know, actually building the attack surface at the end of the day, don't necessarily realize the mistakes they're making. Or if they do, they don't necessarily realize the prescience of the actual threat. So the thing, you know, that I sort of prioritize when it comes to helping people get better at defense is making sure that the impact of the offensive work is maximized, but then also the you know, the downstream feedback around, okay, what do you do next? Like, why did this happen?
This is the drum that Katie has been beating for years. And in fact, yeah, you know, her whole business is based on this concept. And you put it in a rather crass way that I'm going to repeat because I know you won't say it in a public interview, but you are known, Casey, to say it's no good knowing where you're f***ed if you can't fix it. So I'm guessing, though, that people kind of understand these days, don't they, that you need to be ready for a bug bounty program. You need to get your ducks in a row. Otherwise, you're going to get these, you know, bug reports come in and you can't really action them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that specifically, you know, what I will caveat that with is that specifically applies to throwing it open to the public. Like, I do think, you know, in terms of getting people to a better position of understanding of how good or bad or ugly things actually are. Like, the whole idea of bringing in, you know, the additional firepower of the crowd privately to basically build that case. What we've seen a lot of our customers do is actually use it as fodder to go back into the rest of the organization and say, hey, listen, you know, we may have thought that we were really good at this stuff. Like, here's some proof that we've got some work to do. So using that as a catalyzing effect, I think that's really powerful. But that's, you know, with the strong caveat of doing it privately and getting those things in a row before you open it out to the public. Because once you've done that, that's an ongoing conversation that you're having with the entire internet, and you need to be ready for that.
But again, I mean, this is going to involve consultants. This is going to involve change. This is going to, in some cases, involve introducing proper source and version control. This is big stuff, right? So whereas with the case of crowdsourced testing, it's all very, very simple. So I guess I'm driving at, right, is where can we get the crowd focused on defensive stuff?
Yeah, look, there's a bunch of different ideas that we've had, as I mentioned. Like one that I'll volunteer now, and you know,
hope no one rips it off.
Well, you know, someone definitely will, because that seems to be what happens. But what will what, you know, we've been thinking about is the whole idea of creating a defensive bonus for the creation of like bespoke WAF rules to protect issues with web applications. So the whole idea is, okay, if you find a vulnerability and you're the first under, you know, normal bounty guidelines, you get the reward for that. But then there's a bonus if you can create a rule that basically mitigates the impact of that vulnerability whilst preserving the functionality of the target, right?
See, that's a great idea. I mean, but is that going to be are you going to have like one bug crowd approved WAF? Is that how that's going to work?
So that's where it gets tricky, because, you know, you've got iRules, you've got mod security, you've got regex, you've got like 5 million different ways to write a WAF rule. I don't think that's like the way that we've been thinking about doing that is basically, you know, grabbing a bunch of people from the crowd and figuring out who understands mod security and then kind of going from there. Because you can port that stuff across, like it's free, you can get access to it, it's easy to at least learn conceptually.
So could it be the case that the people who write the WAF rules and the people who find the bugs, they're different people? So the bug is created and then that gets kicked off as like a defensive bounty for the rules creation team.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean,
see, that's cool. That makes a lot of sense.
The whole idea of pairing, it makes perfect sense. So that's the kind of stuff that I'm thinking about with that, because it's really, you know, what you can't necessarily do is say you found a bug, go create a patch that can be rolled into the code base, because the tester's not necessarily going to have access to that code. And even if they do, they don't understand the regression and the recursion that happens into other systems within the company. So there's limits to the whole thing. So it's like, okay, how can you with as little impact to what's inside the four walls of the business, create a band-aid for the problem that you found to buy the customer time to actually remediate
I'm so glad you said that, because people love to on WAFs, right? But in terms of,
they've got a purpose.
They do, man. Like for remediation, like quick remediation, not perfect, but quick remediation, they come in pretty handy, you know?
Yeah. Well, when you think about, you know, when you think about some of the vulnerabilities that get found that we see in, you know, systems that haven't been touched for the last 10 years, or, you know, stuff that's in like a language that's esoteric or whatever, like the regression that needs to happen before that vulnerability can be remediated, it's not necessarily because the company's bad at security. It's because it's a really complex issue that's buried really deep in their code. Yeah. So in that sort of circumstance, it's perfectly, in my mind, acceptable for them to figure out how to put a Band-Aid on the front of it while they're getting that done.
Yeah, like words like cascading failure come to mind, right? Like it's fixing a bug deep in the code. You know, it's like the butterfly flapping its wings in New York, leading to a hurricane in leading to a cyclone in Queensland.
Yeah, especially if it's COBOL, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You start talking about stuff like that and this gets really complicated really fast. So, you know, buy people time, help them reduce their risk, help them do it properly. That to me is a pretty cool option.
So let me ask you, Casey, over the last year, I want you to compare, because we are trying to make the case here that bug bounties are now a mainstream part of the information security product mix, okay? We're trying to make this case that it's an established, mature discipline that's not going anywhere and will just sort of be refined and not maybe, there'll be no pivots. It's an established thing. So I want you to tell me, if you can, where BugCrowd is today versus where it was a year ago. I mean, what can you tell me in terms of, you know, growth, whether that's numbers of customers or revenue or whether that's types of businesses or types of programs? What can you tell me that supports this idea that bug bounties are now a mature offering?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that we're going to release as a part of our bug bounty report that we do every year that I won't preempt. But, you know, suffice to say, I think the number of verticals that we've been working in has increased, and the number of customers within those more traditional verticals that are away from like your Bay Area type companies has increased as well, along with technology companies continuing to get more and more proactive about it. So, you know, from a traction standpoint, that's definitely picked up. The crowds continue to grow and accelerate, I think, over the past period of time, which
what have you got, like 60,000 on the platform now? I think every time I look, the number's higher.
75 at the
moment. Man, see, this is my point. 60,000 was my joke number, and it's actually the real number's actually higher.
Yeah. So that's pretty extraordinary. And that to me is testimony of, you know, the success of the people that are active right now, but also the interest coming in from outside, which when you think about the problem that we're actually solving here, it's not enough defenders to go around to protect the internet. So the fact that like bug bounties are making cybersecurity interesting, it's a part of what's like, you know, up leveling the profile of this industry as a whole and seeing, you know, fresh blood join. That's pretty cool, and that excites me a lot.
What's your number of active users, though? Right, because everyone—it's sort of like Twitter talking about their number of users, but like, you know, take out the bots, and it's a little less impressive. You can't have 70,000 people all contributing hammer and tongs to your platform.
No, absolutely, yeah, no. So those, just to be super clear on that, like that's the number of unique signups on the platform, and we do go through basically checking to make sure that people are human and not bots and so on. But in terms of the folk that are actually active, it runs at about 11-12%
of the overall population.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, there's no security company that has that many like testers, right?
Yeah. And when you start to be able to drill down into, you know, specific groups of skill sets, like the number of people in that active cohort that are IoT specialists or mobile or, you know, whatever else, like it gets pretty interesting pretty quickly. Cause you're right. Like, no one out there kind of has that. And, you know, what we're doing is basically just connecting the latent talent pool that's out there with the demand.
Well, I'm going to look forward to hearing what the listeners think about this, because I've really enjoyed this process of actually trying to stake a claim. The claim being, of course, bug bounties are now a mature part of the InfoSec tech mix. I think you gave it a red hot go, Casey. I think that was impressive stuff. This has been a real pleasure. Thank you for joining us on Soapbox, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Pat, and congrats too.
That was Casey Ellis there of BugCrowd with a nice long conversation all about bug bounty programs. I do hope you enjoyed this Soapbox podcast. I'll be back in the weekly Risky Business Show next week, but until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.